Okay, thank you, Eberhard. Well, I'd like to thank Eberhard and Grisha for having me, however briefly, and I again apologize for not being able to make it as long as I wanted to. So this is some of it will be spoken under the control of watchful Annick Bouquet. So if I step over line on MHD, just kill me, okay? I mean it as a question. Obviously, there's a number of specialists and people that devote lots of their time on turbulence. So the question, I'll be talking about the dynamo, but the main question I'll ask and probably not answer so much is what's turbulence got to do with it? Okay, and if any, what does it do? So I'll restrict myself for most of the talk on a situation like the Earth. So it has a magnetic field, all right. So what I mean by the Earth, I mean liquid metals. I mean things where the Prandtl number for the magnetic field is very small. That is, things that diffuse much faster than with a much larger diffusion than the fluid. And I'll talk about experiments mostly. And by experiments, there will be a little bit of computer experiments as well as lab experiments. They're about the same thing. So the one thing I want to remember from the observation of natural dynamos is that, well, they exist. Now I think that point is set. They're dynamical. Most objects that we know which have a dynamic magnetic field have a magnetic field that changes with time. Be it the 11-year cycle of the sun, or very intermittent reversals of the Earth, which take place every 100,000 years or so. Okay? And those are there's something I want to remember somewhere on the side of what we want to do, is that you have things that have 11 years and things that have 10 to the 5 years. And again, it's a behavior that would be those are time scales that would be hard to compute from the basic parameters of the problem. Okay, so that dynamics is not so so simple. All right, what does, and then I'll sketch what turbulence is important here. It's because since the fluids where all these dynamo processes will take place are turbulent. So it's a little bit like it was described yesterday for clouds. It's not that we love turbulence that much, it's that in this thing, it just exists. There is no easy way, and I'll talk about that a little bit, but there's no easy way to make a flow that will have the right ingredients and not be turbulent. So it's not a choice, it is just there. Now the question that we may ask is, do we care or don't we, is the interesting one. So that's the outline. I'll talk about dynamos and various applications of that. One of the, does that go? No? Yes? Oui? Okay. Click? Okay. I'm given the, yes, okay, back, no.
Some magnetic effects.
Good. You know, okay. I don't know. Microsoft is always able to crash any computer that I know of. So here's just to go back to the equations just a little bit. It's the dynamo thing is a surprising object if you look at it. What you want to is you want a magnetic field to grow spontaneously from the motion of a conducting fluid. Now, the equation for the growth of the magnetic field is this one. This is nothing else than the curl of Ohm's law. All right, so you write Ohm's law, you take the curl of it, and that's what you get. That equation is very reminiscent of a number of equations that people in fluid dynamics work with. Most of them are known not to be able to increase the whatever they are moving spontaneously. I mean, obviously, you do not create more paint by mixing paint. You can prove, it takes a little longer, that you cannot have gradients going to infinity by mixing gradients. This one will be left for Grisha, okay? you tell us about whether you can blow omega in a finite time with the appropriate... Yeah, miss another equation, yes. Oh, Prelimal stress is almost the same equation as that. Yes. Yes, I agree. So the question on how would the energy of that increase is not easy. And since all these basic equations, I mean, not the third one, let's forget about the third one, which is just for being provocative. But the first two, you can show that there is no increase of that in the long run, it's not surprising that the dynamo field is clogged with anti-dynamo theorem. There's any number of them that says if you do this and do that, you will not be able to generate a dynamo. Let me give you a very easy one, because all the, just for the people in theory, all the anti-dynamo theorem always boils down to the same thing. You express the fields in whatever conditions, let's say here, axisymmetric. So if the magnetic field is axisymmetric, then you can write it like this. And then you plug this into Ohm's law, and instead of the phi component, you write this for r times the phi component of the vector potential. Then that's the equation you get. And that's a diffusion advection equation, and diffusion advection equation doesn't have a growing solution in the limit of large time. So anti-dynamo theorem. They all look the same. The very interesting, you have a small way out. That is, you can show that you have small deviations from axisymmetry, then you can have a dynamo. So small is okay, it's just zero that is forbidden. If that rings a bell with mechanics, that's all right. Yes. Yes. That's in that version of Kalin theorem. Yes. You just cannot sustain an axisymmetric dynamo. Good question. No. Is it? It did the right time period. Yes. Interesting. Why not? So it's an instability. You have to be able to produce induced fields at a larger rate than the Joule effect is going to diffuse it away. So for this, when you balance the two, you get onto the magnetic Reynolds number. So it's an instability that will only exist when the magnetic Reynolds number exceeds a critical value. And for most fluids, the Reynolds number will be nu over eta times the magnetic Reynolds number. That is, the magnetic Reynolds number divided by the Prandtl number. And that's why I said so far that I will restrict myself to liquid metals. For liquid metals, PM is very small, so that if RM is of order 1, then Reynolds number is of the order of a million. Okay, so it's just because I want to have an instability and have this number large enough that I end up with a huge Reynolds number. It's not that I need it, it's a byproduct of this. And that byproduct has a huge consequence, but I will not discuss that here, but it has a huge consequence for work in the lab. The consequence is that if you express the magnetic Reynolds number not as a function of Reynolds number, but as a function of the power you need to generate the flow, how much watts you need, then you find a very depressing scaling, is that RM goes like power and size to the 1/3. And that's a very, very depressing scaling, because if you want to turn the knob like you would do in any instability, just crank the control parameter until you hit the instability. Okay, it's what people do for any fluid dynamics instability. Here, if you want to double the magnetic Reynolds number, you have to multiply the power input by 8. Okay? And since basically the factor L here is how complex is the engineering, and the P here is just the size of the grant. So it's a dollar a watt. Okay? So you need 100 kilowatts. I mean, and if you miss the threshold by a factor of 2, you'll need to multiply the size of the grant by 10, which most funding agencies don't really like. Okay? And that's just what turbulence scaling implies. All right. Then the other depressing news was brought about by Anik and co-workers. So that's another depressing one. It's the fact that if you look at the critical magnetic Reynolds number you need for any given flow, I won't discuss the Taylor Green here, as a function of the Prandtl number. So this is the Earth. This is 1/10 100. Okay, so the Earth is way here. Okay, that's where we stand, and you're trying to see how the critical threshold for producing a dynamo changes when the Reynolds number increases. That really is a Reynolds number, okay? And again, what we want to know is what it is up there, and the depressing finding that Yannick Ponty, Pablo Minini, and Nick Bouquet and the others had is that it's much easier to produce a laminar dynamo than a turbulent one. How much easier? Well, I don't know what the units are, but this probably is around 10, and this is 200, okay? So it is 20 times. 20 times to the power 3 is how much power you need, okay? So when you go from here to here, you will need to spend 20 to the cube more power, dollars, whatever, okay? That's what it is. So how does it work in real life? I mean, can you make a dynamo out of it? Well, the first thing you can do is you try to ignore turbulence altogether. And that's what people have done until 2000. You take that equation, and you look for a solution of that equation with a velocity field that you can write. Okay? So you set yourself U equal to blah, 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 put it in there and show that it has a growing solution. There's very little flows that are actually known. One of them was found by Ponomarenko, who I think is the only science paper he's ever written in his life before doing something else. But he's written one paper that I know of, and it's the basis of the Riga dynamo. It rides a flow which is just a helical wave going down. So imagine a rotating fan and fluid doing this. And people have built that flow in Riga. And in 2001, they could show that if you increase the velocity of the fluid up to a certain point, the magnetic field will grow spontaneously and have a given value. It just grows out of nothing. And that's a helical wave. And people were very happy because the threshold here is equal to the laminar prediction of the threshold. So just ignore turbulence, okay? But increasing the control parameter brought about no further dynamics. It was just a helical wave. The second example that people know of is the Roberts flow. And Robert's flow is just a generalization of the first one. How would you call that? An array of helices. Okay? And people have built that in Karlsruhe. And they forced the fluid in tubings to move on these helices. And in 2001 as well, they generated a steady dynamo. And again, the threshold was very close to the laminar prediction. That is, ignore turbulence, and that's all right. Okay? But when you've done that, you've actually completely forced the flow to mimic your solution. Okay, if the flow is, I mean, all the pipes and tubing and all this in the experiment is heavily constrained so that it does exactly what that solution says. And the second thing is, however the control parameter was turned, it never got to a stage of the magnetic field having more interesting dynamics. Okay, which is something that people want. No, it's a Reynolds number is no. The magnetic Reynolds number here is 100, and the Reynolds number is a million. Yeah. It was huge.
So why was it short? Why turbulence didn't you know about?
The turbulence, let's put it this way. The turbulence developed, but the mean flow was forced by pipes and tubing to follow a particular geometry. That is, in the Karlsruhe experiments, you had tubes running around like this, so that the flow actually does that helical motion. Okay? It is not the fluid deciding what it should do. Okay? To get a dynamo at low Reynolds. Well, I can talk about that in the end. There's a group of Stirling Colgate in Socorro, which is trying to achieve a laminar dynamo. Like I could describe that as well a little bit. So people, the next step after that, yes. Hmm. Yes, but the experiments is done in Socorro at the what is it called? Socorro School of Mines, is that it? Yeah. But it's in Los Alamos. Yeah. Oh, you don't want to fly with them. Not in this type of setup. I'll describe in the end other types of setup where people hope to achieve this with independently controlled parameter. But here, not in that experiment. You can get into a week more. Not the same one. You can get into the magnetic stress and all will get you into a weak turbulence regime at very high PM and very low RE. So the next step with this thing was to try to get away from mimicking a flow, a solution, and try to see if you could get a dynamo in something more homogeneous. Okay, and that's what we get. And I'll describe very little of the VKS experiment. I'll just use it as an illustration. So that's what we get. We took our favorite washing machine. I know that, I mean, all of you guys know what the washing machine is, right? It's a cylinder. In the cylinder, you put two discs and you rotate them. And these things has the advantage of being able to have differential rotation because the disc rotates in opposite direction. And since when you rotate a disc, you have a centrifugal fan, so you're pumping the fluid in the center. You're pumping fluid which rotates, and you have helicity. Okay? And if the other disk is rotating in the opposite direction, then it is sucking fluid upwards and also rotating in the opposite direction, so the helicity is the same. Okay? So you're trying something that has, and well, I'll describe why it is desired, but something that has differential rotation, helicity, and if you increase the Reynolds number past a critical value, you heat a subcritical bifurcation and you produce a dynamo. Okay. Unfortunately, the dynamo that you produce is very close to being axisymmetric. It can't be, right? But it's very close to being axisymmetric. And the fact that that dynamo is very close to axisymmetry says that it cannot be generated by the mean flow motions. Okay? Because the mean flow motions, I'll describe that a little bit later, but the mean flow motions would say, I want a dynamo to be a transverse dynamo. Okay, and here you have a dynamo along the axis, so it is not the one that is due to the motion that I just described. Okay, if anything, it is due from all the fluctuations from the mean flow. Fluctuations from the mean flow is something people usually call turbulence. Okay. Now, and the bonus is when we were changing the velocity of those impellers, huh? Oh, the scale is about so it's a cubic meter of sodium, and the propellers are about 46 centimeters. Well, it's 450 kilowatts of stirring. Plus the same thing for cooling. The building that we live in, and the experiment is about the size of this room. The building we live in is a megawatt of power consumption. But again, I can describe all this if you want, but that was not the purpose of the talk. So the bonus was that if you rotate these things at different velocities, you get different dynamos. That's for increasing velocity difference between the two. You can have pockets of steady dynamos, and you have oscillating dynamos, or you could have dynamos with intermittent reversal, just like the Earth, all these very strange bursting things here. So you had a dynamo with the dynamics. But it's the good thing. No, yes. The Rossby number and Ekman number are tens of orders of magnitude different than from the Earth. No, it's not an Earth dynamo. It's a physicist dynamo. Nothing to do with what the Earth does.
So about all these dynamos that generate that are some kind of mechanical.
Yes. Yes. You can well, if you put in, that would have been interesting to show you. If you put in the numbers of what we've learned from the experiments, and you say I want convection to do that, that will not work.
The reason you never reach the turbulent.
Yeah. You never reach the turbulent regime. You never reach a stirring that is large enough. It just doesn't make sense. It's just that the fluid properties are not the right properties. Invent a new fluid. Well, it will not work. It will not work. No, it'll never work. You'll never make a convective dynamo in the lab ever. So we have the time scales and we have dynamics. But all this is now turbulence is back. So we have to understand what turbulence does on all this. All right, we have to make a detour on mean field MHD. I'm sorry about that, but it's always when you say turbulence and dynamos, it gets at some point. So what's the story? The story is, let me take something like the Earth. It's a little easier for me to explain that the VKS. It's very easy to see how differential rotation is able to generate a poloidal field, a toroidal field out of poloidal one. Okay, advection of magnetic field lines, if you start with magnetic field lines along the axis, and you have any amount of differential rotation, something like this. You start like this and you twist it. It's very easy to see how you build a toroidal field through the advection of magnetic field lines. So if you want to make a dynamo, you got to find a way to go from that toroidal field and have some velocity gradients that will produce, again, a poloidal component. And that's where everyone has a problem. Okay? And the solution to that problem is a little mystery that people call the alpha effect. The thing is simple. If you can have a current which turns to be parallel to a magnetic field, then it's very easy that this current here will regenerate your magnetic field. Now, the whole question is, how in the world do you get a current to be parallel to a magnetic field? Okay? Usually, we all learn that U cross B, whatever, it sounds to be perpendicular. And the solution to this is the following one. That's good. The solution to this is helical motion. So if you start from a magnetic field line like this, and you have a flow that twists it, you go up and turn, right? So that magnetic field line did this. Now, a magnetic field line that has a loop like this means a current like this, okay? So helical motion out of that magnetic field line here is making a current which is in the opposite direction parallel to the magnetic field line you started with. That's the basis. That mechanism is due to Parker, and it's the basis of the alpha effect. Okay. Now, turbulence. How do you get an alpha effect from a turbulent flow? Well, you do exactly. Eberhard would be the person to do this to you. You do exactly Prandtl mixing length model. That's how it's called in regular hydrodynamics, and you do the same thing. You write the equation for the fluctuations, of course, ignore the average thing. The average of the induction equation says, okay, you got a Reynolds stress tensor. Okay, all you have to do is estimate that Reynolds stress tensor. So you write the equation for the induced field, okay? And now you get rid of everything you don't understand. And the way physicists do this usually is by inventing names. All right? So you invent first order smoothing approximation, as it is known in books, means I have no idea of how these compare to this, so let's just throw it away. All right? If anyone has a better excuse, he should speak up right now, remain mute forever. But so far, that's my understanding of the first order smoothing approximation. Of course, when you've... That's basically the same thing. Well, let's not badmouth it too much. It's a word that was coined first, I guess, by Keith Moffat, so he's a well-behaved enough person so that we should respect that. So when you've done that, you basically have a linear operator, which is for the fluctuation, which says that it grows like the curl of the EMF, which is produced by the large-scale magnetic fields being sheared out by the small-scale fluctuations. Okay? So you solve for this. It's not, and there's any number of cases where it can be done easily. You solve for this, and of course, when you're going to expand, it's just Prandtl mixing length. When you're going to expand this as a function of the source, okay, you go from the source and its derivatives. So now, the last thing you have to play is the fact that U is a real field, B is a pseudo-vector, and you're taking a cross product, okay? So that says that B here being a pseudo-vector, alpha is a pseudo-scalar, and if the next term that comes in, which is the curl of B, it's the curl of a pseudo-vector, so beta is a real scalar, whatever. when you're through doing this, you have this wonderful equation. This wonderful equation is fantastic because it says that the growth of B is proportional to B plus diffusion. Okay, just take any delta mu flow where the curl of B will be parallel to B, and this will grow in no time. Okay, all right, I have a dynamo. Okay, that's why people love it that much. So it says the two things, well, fluctuations can help you have a turbulent EMF, and of course, as we know, turbulence is diffusive, so fluctuations will enhance the diffusion of magnetic field. Well, follow Keith Moffat again. What you have to do is compute those alpha and beta things from the correlation in the velocity. And now, there's something that people doing regular fluid turbulence like I was are not so much used to, because you have one correlation function, but you want two quantities out of it. Okay? And one quantity you can show is related to the energy. This is just how much shearing you get into the flow. That's the symmetric part of velocity of fluctuation. But you also have the anti-symmetric part of the velocity correlation, and that's the Fourier transform of the helicity in the flow. That is, in the end, you find theoretically something that is very close to what I described before. It is those helical motion that matter, okay? But then again, it's a very unusual manner. We've introduced turbulence that has or doesn't have helicity. Okay, so it's not something like turbulence. There's helical turbulence, non-helical turbulence, all kinds of added features to the turbulence. Now, one of the problems is if you do dimensional analysis starting from this, you find that alpha is a velocity times the magnetic Reynolds number, and that's the 1 over lambda is diffusivity here, and beta is a length scale times the velocity times the magnetic Reynolds number. That's what you would get from dimensionally and first estimate. And then you run into a very interesting problem that has kept people busy for a number of years and heated debates in conferences. Because you're basically building alpha and beta from the same quantity, right? Now, the effective Reynolds number you have is alpha, your velocity, which helps, okay, times the length scale, divided by beta. Now, if I said last that I have alpha equal to a velocity time Rm, and beta a velocity times the length time Rm, and I do alpha L over beta, this is just one. Okay, so if I get into something that is turbulent enough, I mean, the Reynolds number will be one whatever I do. I'll never hit that instability. I cannot increase that number. Okay? So the fact that if you increase the Reynolds number, you do nothing on the magnetic Reynolds number that you want, so you never hit the instability, is something that Alexander Shekershihin calls the runaway problem. So they say, you'll never get an instability, and then people say, yes, you will, and some people say, maybe, okay? And that's when, again, Anik and friends saved us, because I show you this curve again. It says, Alex and runaway approach to this would be this curve increases forever, okay? And the finding with the numerics is that this curve is nice enough to flatten. Now, no one knows if it goes down or if it stays constant. That's another question. Yes. But I don't want to debate this right now. So it says threshold doesn't disappear. Good. That's what we have in the numerics. And I'm just showing you this because if you do the job correctly, now you want an alpha. You want to relate what is the turbulent electromotive force in a flow that is not, you know, that turbulence is very special. For instance, if the turbulence is mirror symmetric, then alpha has to be zero. In a mirror symmetric configuration, a pseudoscalar cannot be non-zero. A pseudoscalar is zero. So that turbulence, a whole bunch of feature. Now, if you say that this turbulence has a preferred direction because you have an applied magnetic field, you have rotation, you have a gradient of turbulence as you would in real flows, and you try to express the mean EMF as a function of all these quantities, beside the incredible headache you get doing this, that's the expression you get. And go fish, which is the one that is actually going to work for you. All right, this is not easy. Well, because it was, we jumped from MHD 101 to MHD 700.
Oh,
okay. So that's all. Yeah, yeah. All right. So where do people stand with all this? Okay, you got a picture. You have a simple picture of twisting a loop, like I showed you, that looks nice, and you have theory that says you could do this with turbulence. How do you go about with this? Now, experimentally, if you do it on purpose, that's a washing machine with only one disc rotating, so it's just one swirl, okay? And if you apply a magnetic field line here, it will indeed be pulled and twisted, so you will create that loop. And if you measure that induced part of the magnetic field, it does grow quadratically before, I don't want to discuss quenching, but it does what you expect, and it really is that mechanism. So if you do it on purpose,
The points are measurements.
The points here is the measurement of that part of the induced magnetic field as a function of rotation, and you indeed find that you have a quadratic alpha effect. So if you organize, it's basically what Riga did, if you organize a big swirl, you have this from mean flow motions. Okay, the point is turbulence. Turbulence, okay, let me generate a helical turbulence in the lab. It's not easy. It's not easy at all. You want to see how much of this is left in the turbulent flow that will have little mean and lots of helical fluctuation. The best machine I know how to do this is the one run by Peter Frick and collaborators in Perm, Russia. And what they do is you imagine a wheel, which is filled with liquid sodium, and you're starting in solid body rotation, okay? As fast as you can. And at time t equal t naught, you hit the brake. Well, it's a MIG brake. I'm not kidding. At time t equal t naught, you hit the brake. The whole thing stops in less than 700th of a second. The time that the whole thing stops. And the liquid shoots. Okay, yeah, the liquid shoots forward. Okay, as it shoots forward, it passes through what my colleagues call it a diverter. Okay, and it's being shot into the fluid like this. Okay, that's the ultimate helical machine that I know of, and when it operates, you don't want to be too close, but that's how it works. And so I'm not going to make describe that experiment because it would take a very long time, but the result is the following one. You do get an alpha effect from turbulent fluctuations, okay? But it's very small.
And it's very non-stationary.
Yeah, it's very non-stationary. And we did sort it out all the terms in that equation.
For some short time, I thought it would be as much compared to beta as the fish.
Yeah.
The point is when all the instabilities develop in fluid.
So what you can follow, in the end, it tends, how big it is, it's about like this. It's about like this. When you're looking for alpha, you're playing the symmetry game. When I reverse this, I got to reverse. It's all a matter of symmetry, huh? These games.
What?
So. Yes. Yes. You. So these. these little diverter thing are about 1/20th of the loop. Well, yeah. But with the best, so it's the best approximation. It is just as much helicity as you can pack into a flow plus scale separation. Okay? And all that buys you is an alpha over U equal to 10 to the minus 2. Okay? So you get, the U is the velocity. U is what you're going to pay for. Alpha is what you want. Okay? So it says that the alpha effect here is very weak. Okay? It's very weak in the best alpha generator I know. Beta effect. Beta effect was measured by the same crowd very recently. It's an incredibly complicated measurement, and basically what you look at for, what you look for, is the skin depth in you've turned the rotating wheel into a solenoid, and you're looking at the small changes in the phase during skin depth penetration of waves, and that's really is complicated. But again, what you find is that the effective viscosity is 25% higher than the molecular velocity. Again, it's small. It's non-zero, it's small. Okay? So alpha and beta, which are born from turbulent fluctuation, they exist. Okay? And I believe these two are the only direct measure evidence of that, but they're very small. Okay. Now, let me get back to this. I'm sorry. If you want to make a dynamo with a very weak alpha here, it means you need an incredibly strong omega. Okay, there's just no other way that you're going to have something efficient enough. And that's indeed what we have observed in our set of experiments. So let me tell you about the first homogeneous dynamo that we've been hunting for a decade. Is that alpha omega here, which is just the one that produces the transverse dynamo I told you doesn't exist. It's very easy to see how it works. If you start from a magnetic field along the lines here, the helicity will generate those loops. So those, remember, the helicity is the same, even if the fluid is going in opposite direction, the helicity is the same on each side. So that magnetic field here induced is perpendicular to the one you applied. And then the shearing motion in the middle of these things, so you have these the loops and then being tilted like this, okay, by the differential rotation. And that produces a magnetic field which is parallel to the one you started with. And that's why that dynamo from the mean motion is a transverse dynamo. So we tried to operate that for a number of years, and it never worked. So it's the induced magnetic field grows like by Km cubed, which is what you expect for alpha omega. But then before you get as much induced field as applied field, so 0.5, it saturates, destroys, and never got to self-excitation. Okay? That's my data, yes. And that's because in that fluid, we had a small amount of alpha, and omega is not strong enough to make it a dynamo. You need alpha omega equal 1, but alpha is 10 to the minus 2, so you need omega equal to 10 to the 2 in order to make a dynamo. So how do you do that? Well, in a homogeneous fluid, we don't know. Okay? So the only way we know how to do that is cheating. How do you cheat? You cheat by using rotating disks that are made of soft iron. And soft iron is a material that has a very weak remnant field, but a very strong relative permittivity. Okay? So that if any amount of, and the in a disk, the easy direction of magnetization is the toroidal one. So if you have any amount of a magnetic field here, which is born from the differential rotation boundary layer between the fluid and the rest, then it will be amplified by a huge factor in the vicinity of soft iron. So when you do this, in addition to this being larger because of the nearby soft iron. That's a calculation done, by the way, by Herzenberg many years ago. Remember, the flow is going outward. Okay, so those magnetic field lines, they're amplified because of the soft iron, but they're also stretched. Okay, so you get more magnetic field lines. Now, any small amount of distortion in a loop like this will produce an alpha effect. And that alpha effect here will produce a current like this, which will in turn produce a vertical magnetic field. So the rotation of one disk made of soft iron is enough to generate a magnetic field. It's not a solid rotor dynamo. You need the fluid. You need the fluid for the differential rotation. You need the fluid for the alpha effect. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And any combination thereof. I'll show you. Now, that was confirmed by numerical simulation by André Giesecke and the people in Dresden. And they show that indeed, if you change from a fluid whose permittivity is 1 to a fluid whose permittivity is about 40, then you reduce the alpha effect you need from the order of the speed of the flow to a hundredth of the speed of the flow, which is exactly what we've measured. All right? So you can indeed generate an alpha omega dynamo with a very strong omega and a very small alpha. Okay? Let me skip this. So we played the game. This is a soft iron disk in red. It's the linear growth I'm talking about here. Yes. So if you spin one disk, the other one is at rest. You hit a value where for a critical value, say about 30. You have a spontaneous growth of the field. Let me not describe this here. That's something else. So now you have one spinning disk can make a dynamo. Okay, that spinning disk can produce a magnetic field in this direction or that direction. You know, B and minus B are both solution of the equations. Okay. So now if you have two spinning disks, you can have magnetic field that are generated in the same direction. By the rotation of each disk, or in opposite direction by the rotation of each disk. At which point, you have all the gradients that we all learned doing nonlinear physics. That is, you have this symmetry, so it's basically the same direction or opposite direction, plus the reversed ones. Okay, so you can call this a dipole if you want, a quadrupole if you want. You write d-dipole is nonlinear function of dipole, quadrupole, because there will be interaction and all that, so you have enough to produce dynamics. And indeed, you produce dynamics, okay? And that dynamics is very easy. Now, I'll do a trick that we've all learned at school. That is, when you want to see whether it's low dimensional, you plot your function as at t plus 1 as a function as where it was at time t. Okay, so that's the magnetic field recorded in the experiment. And I'm plotting it at t plus delta t as a function of what it was at time t. And sure enough, you have points there where the signal spends longer than the other, and it's called a fixed point. Okay? Now, if you have two fixed points and the negative one, that is four fixed points, you can have homoclinic orbits, heteroclinic orbits, and whatnot. Okay? So if you write it, and that's something that François Petrelis and Stéphane Fauve have done a couple of years ago, that if you can write the amplitude equation for this, and that amplitude equation for this is going to match the dynamics. Okay? And you end up with that parameter space of dynamos that we had. All right. So I've convinced you that turbulence was good enough to produce a dynamo if I can have a huge omega effect. Oh, by the way, we're cheating in the lab, but nature does it also, right? The sun dynamo has a huge omega effect near the bottom of the convection zone. Huge amplification of magnetic fields there. But all the explanations of all the dynamics I saw, I showed you, I wasn't referring to turbulence at all. I just gave you mode 1, mode 2, and I said coupling between mode 1 and mode 2 and a low dimensional system, and we know it's all enough to do this, right? So again, in the making of the dynamo, I needed the turbulence. But to explain to you how the turbulence generates the dynamics, I forgot about the turbulence again. Okay, so is it needed? And that's the very hard question. I'm not going to give you an answer for this. I'm just going to show you something we did recently with Roberto Benzi. So how do you simulate all this? Well, you tell Annick to buy more computers. But really, simulating a full-scale dynamo over long periods of time is not possible on a computer because you need to wait so many eddy turnover time. You need several diffusion times of the magnetic field, and each diffusion time of the magnetic field is 100 diffusion time of the velocity, large-scale turnover of the velocity field, so that's not possible. So you do poor man's turbulence, and poor man's turbulence is a shell model, all right? So you write an equation for the velocity field in the shell model. That's the Sabra shell model they've been using. And same thing for the magnetic field. And then, since the question is, what does the turbulence do onto the dynamics I've just described you? So prescribe the dynamics. I don't wait it for it to happen. I'm going to say that in the large scale, I have an amplitude equation that exactly does the dynamics of reversal oscillations and all this I wanted. So I'm going to plug in into the large scale the low dimensional dynamics, okay, as it's given. But I'm keeping things that have a cascade, okay, in the scales, and the cascade will be a turbulent one and a noise, okay? So it does what it's supposed to do. It produces a dynamo. Well, of course, it's all in there. And the dynamo has reversal so that the equations are all right. Okay? Now, the one thing that it doesn't produce, which is find remarkably interesting and surprising, is first, because of the turbulent tau, is the time between reversals. And that time between reversal, which is the time of the dynamics, can vary by orders of magnitude when changing the intensity of turbulence. Now, one should not take that curve too seriously. The detail of that curve here strongly depends on the fact that we've chosen a shell model, okay? But it's the fact that this coupling of two equations with the nonlinear coupling does produce, one, a separation of scale, two, because tau can get much longer than the turnover time. See, that's what we had here. That's 100 diffusion time, and it's not easy to build a dynamics that still has time scales that are hundreds of times larger than the largest time scales in the problem. And that coupling here does it. And also that it may vary by orders of magnitude by varying the turbulence. So it says, for me, the lesson to this is that, okay, we have low dimensional dynamics, but it's activated by a very, very particular noise, turbulence. So it really have to tune those features. I think I'll mainly stop there. I had a curiosity, which I'm going to skip. I'll stop there. I want to tell you, yes. No, we don't, but we will soon, because Roberto has a prediction on that there should be an amplification just like in stochastic resonance. So we'll try to see this. Yes, we haven't so far. So I want to tell you what the next step is. The next step is to find a fluid where you would have independent control of the Reynolds number and of the magnetic Reynolds number. And independent control of that means that you can tune independently the Prandtl number and the magnetic Reynolds number. And the only fluid that people know of that type is a plasma. And it has been proposed by Cary Forrest at University of Wisconsin to use plasmas as the next generation of dynamos. And I think this is a very interesting proposal, and there's a number of groups, including mine, which are moving in that direction. The good thing is that by tuning the electron temperature and the density, you can vary these so that the Reynolds number can be small or large, and the magnetic Prandtl number can be small or large. That is, you have a way to tune turbulence. So we can finally finish answering those questions. If I can have the same situation with more or less turbulence, what will it do on the dynamics? So the experiment that Cary is actually building in Madison, this is about 3 meters in diameter. The plasma is being confined by magnets, which may turn to be a problem. Well, no, it's a lanthanide cathode. It's make a ball of plasma in there, and it's a continuous plasma.
A little discharge.
Yeah. Well, most of the simulation they have is that there will be relatively little magnetic field in the center of the plasma. The other concern is that you have to confine the plasma. So how do people confine the plasma? Using magnetic fields. So what they plan to do is having a permanent magnet, which will be north, south, north, so that we'll have a high multipolar moment and decay rapidly. And those magnets can also be used to move the fluid, because then you need to stir the fluid. How do you stir the fluid? You stick out two little electrodes here, and if you impose a potential difference, you're going to have a current and a magnetic field, therefore a force. And that's how they hope to do it. Well, it's going to be lots of problem, all right? It took us the best part of 12 years to get a liquid sodium dynamo, and may get another 10 years to get a working plasma dynamo. Nevertheless, I believe that this is a very interesting possibility, and it's one that brings closer again our experiments and astrophysics, and I think this is really is the way to go. So I wanted to advertise for this. All right, thank you. Yeah, Paul Roberts and Gary Gassmeier.
That's a real animal. It's a human.
It's
the assumption there, right?
Well, it's a real. That simulation, maybe Yannick should answer that. But that simulation is a breakthrough, because it had all of the equations in a range of parameter which is tens of orders of magnitude away from the real life. But it had all of the equation. And it showed, one, you could have a dynamo, two, it would be a reversing dynamo. It's not so surprising, B and minus B are solutions, but you need to find a way to move one into the other. Maybe, Anik, you want to comment further? No one can simulate a dynamo that has real parameters, I think. Yeah. And even that is, I understand, fairly complicated and new. When was it the paper you guys wrote with Julien Balançoy a couple of years ago to tell how we should simulate the J cross B term? Because it's when you want to get into the nonlinear thing, you also need to model the Lorentz force, and that's complicated, and that's only recent, before.
So it's a completely different regime of energy.
No, it's in the MHT regime. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Exactly. The simulations show that if you have a magnetic Prandtl number of order 10, then you get a dynamo with a very laminar flow. Please help me. Then you get a small scale dynamo, right? You get a zero flux, small scales, like yeah. Yeah. So all the measurements we have so far show that we're covering an enormous amount of scales. But it doesn't show separation between these scales. The spectra are continuous. But the fluid Reynolds number is 10 to the 6, so the Kolmogorov length is about 10 micron, and the thing is a meter across, and the dissipation length for the magnetic field is about a centimeter for a large scale, which is again a meter. So you have a wide range of scales. You do. Food and calls. Saturday.
Saturday is here tomorrow.
I apologize.
If you want to talk more to him, please.